Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, Matty Van Hoof discovered the crack Wi-Fi vulnerability, and he shares his thoughts. Also, Sarah Wachter-Betcher talks about her book, Technically Wrong. Megabot's co-founder, Matt Orline, does a post-battle roundup. And Sharif Hanna from Qualcomm dispels some common misconceptions about 5G technology. All that and more coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, Episode 3, recorded Thursday, October 19th, 2017.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to and about some of the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. We have a lot of people making and breaking tech news today. Yep. I'm super excited for this show.
A lot of making, a lot of breaking. People aren't breaking the stuff that other people made, thankfully.
And some of them may know how to break dance too, which would be a nice bonus.
I don't know. We'll check.
Earlier this week, a security researcher posted a paper on something called crack, spelled with a K, that threatens to basically destroy Wi-Fi privacy using WPA2 encryption. You can see it right here. It's affecting pretty much any device that supports Wi-Fi. And the internet, as you might expect, lost its love and mind. Joining us is Matty Van Hoof, the researcher behind the discovery of crack. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure to have you here. So, Matty, let's start with the big picture. CRACK stands for Key Reinstallation Attacks. Unpack that a little bit for those who aren't clear on how this actually affects WPA2 Wi-Fi security.
So, essentially, what happens when, say, your smartphone or laptop connects to a protected network, a so-called handshake is being executed, which negotiates a key, an encryption key, that will be used to actually scramble and encrypt all the information that you are sending so that people nearby cannot receive it. Now, it's essential that that key will only be used once, because otherwise this encryption, the scrambling, can be undone. And we found that here it goes wrong. We can actually force an Android phone or a smartphone or any smartphone or a laptop into using that key multiple times. In other words, into reinstalling this key. And then we can undo the encryption so we can recover the data that your device is sending.
Wow. And you're talking, I mean, we're so used to seeing, I'm an Android user. I'm so used to seeing, this happened on Android, and it being very specific to a certain classification of devices, manufacturers, whatever. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about, I mean, it's basically internet, you know, devices that connect to the internet, which is everything. I mean, does this also include, like, you know, historically unsecured devices like IoT devices in the home, smart home products, that sort of stuff?
So I would say that nearly all devices that implement Wi-Fi, that can connect to a protected Wi-Fi network, most of them are indeed affected by this attack. Wow. Now, interestingly, there are some operating systems, which is, for example, Windows, which does not completely follow the standard, and because of that, they are not affected by the biggest attack. However, I would assume that most Wi-Fi devices are indeed affected by it.
Mm-hmm. Now, on your site, crackattacks.com, again, spelled with a K, you answer a lot of questions about this. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that you've been seeing reported on this vulnerability as the week has progressed? Because there's been a lot of coverage on this. What were some of those biggest misconceptions?
So that's a good question. I would say one of the misconceptions that I've seen a few times is that carrying out this attack would require the password of the network, and that's not the case. You do not need to have the password to perform this attack. Maybe one other misconception is a lot of people say you need to be really close to the network, and of course you need to be within range to be able to connect to the wireless network. However, there are special antennas which allow you to connect to a Wi-Fi network and carry out the attack, say, from a distance of up to 2 or maybe even 3 kilometers. Oh, so, wow. Yeah, you have to be nearby, but on the other hand, you also don't have to be that close.
Hmm. So we've heard that iOS, the newest version of iOS, has a fix, and Windows has a fix, and you know, we've heard all that. And what I've read is that that means we're less vulnerable. Can you explain a little bit about what that means? I mean, are we still vulnerable even though it's been patched?
Well, I would say that as a home user, if you then update your Windows on your iOS devices, in that case, I would say you're secure. When you connect to a more enterprise, a more business network, for example, a university or a company that has a lot of access points, so a lot of places where the wireless signal is being broadcasted, then there could still be a bug in the equipment that they use. But for your home network, if you just update your Windows or your laptops and your smartphones, then you're already safe.
Now, you know, a lot of times with discoveries like this, especially researchers discover a vulnerability, it's well before anyone is actually doing anything with it. Are you aware of any tools at this point that are kind of resulting in someone actively exploiting this vulnerability at this point? Have there been any signs that that's actually happening at this point?
So I'm not aware of any people or hackers that are currently using this tool to carry out attacks. It could be that someone made a tool but has not yet made it public. That's one possibility. But I do think that making a program to carry out these attacks, it requires some technical expertise. So it could be, say, a few weeks before this happens. And then the question is also, will they release this tool or not? But of course, once such a program is available, then it becomes very easy for normal IT people to download such a tool and perform our attacks.
I'm interested in the process, your process. Like, how long have you been working on this paper? What gave you the idea? I mean, was it, did you get a tip from someone, or was it just something that you were sitting, you know, around in the shower or something, and it's just, you just thought of it? How does it work?
Yeah, so here we've been researching the security of Wi-Fi networks for quite a while already, I think more than 4 years. And while we were working on existing research, which was testing some other security aspects of a Wi-Fi network, I at one point basically just had an insight. I was reading some code. I was looking at one particular line, and I just had an insight, hey, what if something goes wrong here? What if this key is being installed? So it's a combination on the one hand, studying this wireless security for a long time already and having the right insight at the right moment. And that happened, I think, around half a year ago, and then we started to investigate it in detail. We wrote a paper, then in the summer we contacted the companies, and here we are today.
And is it competitive? Were there other people trying to get there before you? Is it like what we, you know, like a journalist trying to chase a story, or is it really just you guys?
Well, I would assume that it was mainly us, because this technology that protects your Wi-Fi network, so the one we attacked, it has already existed for more than 14 years. And during that time, no one has found an attack like us against it. So a lot of people assumed that it was secure. I mean, there are even mathematical proofs which try to formally prove that it is correct. So it's a very surprising finding. And with that in mind, I don't think there was there were other researchers that were really looking at this.
Now, you've also posted a script on GitHub that basically tests access points for the crack attack. If someone, you know, downloads that and finds that their access point is vulnerable, I mean, what is the recommendation there? Obviously, updating the firmware, as you say, updating it when there's a security update. But given that there are a lot of devices that there won't be a security update, Android, and you know, a lot of other devices that just aren't typically updated with the same frequency as others that are. I mean, what is the recommendation there? Is it that you just don't use them anymore, or like where do you go with that?
So that's a good question. So if you find that your access point is vulnerable, or in the future, I will also release the scripts to test if your Android or your smartphone is vulnerable. In that case, you can try to put some pressure on the company if a lot of people start to complain. But of course, it will be likely that certain devices will not get updated. And in fact, I'm quite sure of that. That's indeed a problem. So what ordinary users can do is, first and for all, when they visit the website, make sure that HTTPS is being used, then all your data is still properly protected. And we are also going to look into ways to other ways to try to lower the impact of attacks. So we are looking into things where if devices don't get updates, it's still possible to protect them somehow. But that's something we are still investigating.
Yeah, and that's the biggest frustration for me. I mean, I don't even know how how much faith I have that a lot of these devices are going to get updated. Like Google has an update scheduled for, I think, their November security update. But as we know with Android, that's the first step. And from there, it falls in the hands of the OEMs to, you know, to actually take it to the finish line and bring it to their devices. But that doesn't help a device that's 3 or 4 years old that doesn't get updates anymore. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of left out in the cold.
Yeah, exactly. And that's quite a known problem with Android, that if they have a security vulnerability, that a lot of people do not get updates. And also with other Wi-Fi devices, it's true. I don't expect that a lot of them will be updated. I think the latest ones, yeah, they will get an update. Yeah. But indeed, a lot of people will be left in the cold, and that's very unfortunate. Also, especially with the Android case, attackers could abuse this with, they could combine this with other weaknesses, with other vulnerabilities, which would really make the impact quite bad.
Yeah, I suppose we'll be following this. Matty Vanhoef, first of all, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. And secondly, going backwards, thank you for discovering this, because everybody needs to know about it. And it's super important. So it's really great work that you're doing. Where can people follow everything, all the research and everything that you're doing online?
So I have a Twitter account online. You can follow that. It's my last name, Vanhoef, M, with the M at the end. I also have a blog, but that doesn't get updated that frequently. So the best thing is to follow my Twitter feed.
Right on. Thank you again, Matty, and best of luck with your research. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Thank you. So in the wake of hashtag MeToo, it gives some of us hope that sexism and sexual abuse awareness might bring about some kind of positive change. But our next guest says that sexism, bias, and worse are baked right into our products. Sarah Wachter-Bechter is the author of Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you write that tech is part of every aspect of our lives, but most of us are not really asking why our products are designed the way they are. Technology was supposed to be the great equalizer, getting rid of racism and sexism, but we're actually seeing a lot of the opposite. Talk a little bit about some of the biggest offenders.
Sure. So when I started looking at this subject, it really came out of experiences that I had and my friends had with technology that just seemed alienating, or that seemed like it wasn't really understanding our complex identities. And I started scratching a little bit deeper and realizing that this problem exists all over the place. So, for example, it's sometimes the things that might seem on their surface a little bit small, like, I don't know, if you're, say, Google and you launch your... I'm sorry, if you're Apple and you launch your health app without including a period tracker, right, which is something they did, and it took them a full year to backtrack and include that into the product. Or it might be another kind of small example, like let's say that you are a company like Snapchat, and you throw up this filter one day, and that filter turns out to be maybe racially insensitive, like they did with their anime filter, which was supposed to look like anime, but really gave you buck teeth and squinty eyes and these really stereotypically Asian features that were pretty offensive. Those examples, you know, on the one hand, they seem kind of small in that they're just little blips on the radar of all the tech that we interact with daily. But when I started looking deeper, what I realized was that there were all of these these ways that those problems actually go much deeper. It's not just something that exists at the interface. It's something that's also getting built into things like algorithms that are powering software. So that's everything from image recognition that isn't as good at identifying people of color, to the ways that, you know, sexism might be baked into natural language processing that then affects things like software that's being used to evaluate resumes. And so you find that all of the little examples can actually spin out into much greater problems and are in a lot of ways kind of these red flags that technology just isn't taking real people into account and can be perpetuating the bias that I think tech often wants to think it's getting rid of.
So this week in the news, there was a good example of this. Google Maps came out with a new feature where it would tell you how many cupcakes you could eat if you walked somewhere instead of drove somewhere. But they got rid of it really quickly. Does that give you some hope that things are changing?
It gives me a little bit of hope, but I think we should talk about this a little more because I actually love this example. I love this example because it's a perfect encapsulation of how things go wrong and how they might seem at their surface like not a big deal, but are kind of a big deal. So in this particular example, what Google Maps did is it launched this kind of pilot. They were just testing it out to some users where they would include, yeah, that calorie count and then how many mini cupcakes that was for walking somewhere. And on its surface, it's like, okay, well, you know, lots and lots of people want to track their health. We have, you know, lots of people who are trying to lose weight in this country. This is going to be great. This is going to be helpful. But the minute I saw that product, I thought, okay. Well, what if you have an eating disorder and you really don't like tracking calories because actually that's one of the triggers for your eating disorder? What if you maybe are not somebody who feels like calories are an accurate reflection of your health? What if you're somebody who thinks that it's a little bit insulting to have this kind of feminized food put in your face to talk about your health? What if you just want to turn it off and there wasn't an option for that? So the minute I saw that product, I thought, you know, there are like 10 ways that I could see this going wrong. And so what really surprised me was that this had made it that far at all. Like, how did that team not anticipate any of this and get all the way to actually putting this into users' hands without realizing that it had such fatal flaws?
Yeah, it's an interesting example because when I think of that example and I think of like, well, would it be different if a different food was used? Let's say it was, I don't know what that different food is. I don't know whether it makes it better
like
or worse
to
like
put
like a French fry or a vegetable or whatever. Because when you think of a company like Google, they're quantifying everything, right? Everything's quantified. And when you've got data over here that's quantified and data over here, and hey, what happens when we mix these things together? In some ways, that can be a really good thing to do. It's interesting that there is a perspective, that there's this big kind of shift happening where we look at these things. Maybe they seemed wrong for a very long time, but now people are getting active about why something like this might actually be insensitive to a certain group of people. Do you think this is intentional, or is it just really a matter of, you know, staffing at Google, for example, not matching the many different categories of people that there are to have that perspective?
You know, I do think that that it is unintentional, but I don't think that it's innocent. And I want to make a distinction there because I think that tech companies really routinely say, oh, well, we didn't intend to do that. We didn't foresee this happening. And you hear this a lot. I mean, you know, we heard that just recently from Facebook after it came out that they were allowing people to target ads to anti-Semitic slurs. They said, you know, well, we never anticipated people using our system this way. And that's a really kind of pat response. And I guess my answer to that is you should have. By now, you should have. Because there have been so many examples of this kind of thing going haywire. I think that anytime you're trying to launch a new feature that that is sort of putting something else in front of your user that they didn't necessarily ask for, you got to think this through. And if you're not thinking this through, it's on you. So I do think, you know, the lack of diversity on teams, the sort of constant drive toward upping engagement, I think that those things are a factor as well. But I also really think that there's a lot of a lot of opportunities for tech to solve these problems that should be pretty easy for them to take. And I would say it's time that they start stepping up and taking them.
Well, I think you bring up a good point about being able to turn it off. I know that with the Amazon Echo, when they had the drop-in feature, or no, it was the call feature. When they first introduced that, it had everyone in your contacts would automatically, if you, as soon as you got an Amazon Echo and signed up for this feature, everyone would see who had been in your contacts. And that is not considering anyone who might be suffering, you know, someone might be stalking them, or, you know, they might have an old boyfriend in their contacts, and you couldn't turn it off. That was the issue. And I think a lot of people, when they hear about the cupcake story or that, they think, oh, like, everybody's just being so sensitive. But really, just being able to turn it off, it's something I don't want. Like, it seems crazy to me that they just don't include that ability. It's clearly that they haven't thought that anyone would be affected by it.
And I think that what's really problematic about saying, like, oh, well, what's the big deal? It's just some cupcakes, is that it assumes you understand what can be a big deal to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that you're going to make a lot of bad assumptions that way. But, you know, the reality is that people's lives are complicated and people come from so many different backgrounds, and trying to say like that there's going to be some sort of culturally and socially neutral food that you could position in front of people that you, that would be fine. I think it's probably, you know, you're going to do it wrong. So I really think that one of the big problems, it's not just that you can't turn it off, but it's also that it's a feature that isn't opt-in. I mean, it's not like you're turning it on, right? I think that if I think it's a great feature to be able to turn on a calorie counter to show how, you know, how many calories you might burn if you walk instead of drive. That's a great feature to be able to turn on. I think it's a terrible feature to force people into.
Yeah, I wonder as users, you know, who are using all of these products, you know, for better or worse, you know, they're shown all sorts of examples of ways that things are being done correctly in technology, or let's say inoffensively. And then there are, you know, they're also, like you say, being presented with examples of whether they want it or not, of ways that are not kind of taking all of that into consideration. What power do users have to kind of demand more from tech companies, to demand that they do things different, hold themselves to a higher standard in that regard?
Yeah, I think this is one of the really tough questions, because it's, you know, it's not like this is just like a shop and you can vote with your dollars, right, and you can shop somewhere else, right? Like, if you're not paying Google money or you're not paying Facebook money, then you can't just take the business elsewhere. And in many ways, there, you know, there isn't necessarily always an alternative. There are some alternatives to some of these products. But, you know, if you tell somebody to just cancel their Facebook account, in a lot of ways, that's like telling them, well, you know, just cut off access to of half of your family that you don't talk to otherwise. And so because of that, I think it's hard to think of, like, what do we actually do about it? But what I would say this is a tough problem, because it's a big cultural issue. It's not about necessarily every one of these individual issues. We have to tackle it on that more cultural level, societal level, which means that it happens at scale and it happens over time, which sucks, because it means that all these little problems are going to keep cropping up. But what I've noticed this past year is that there is some momentum toward change. And I think we can see that when we look at what happened at Uber this year. You know, a lot of the implosion at Uber, that was precipitated by major outcry through the Delete Uber campaign. And then after Susan Fowler's blog post went live about sexual harassment at Uber, there was a huge public outcry about that. When those things happen and when they do hit the media, that is when companies start to pay attention. We saw that last week, even with the boycott on Twitter. I don't think either Twitter or Uber has solved all of the problems that those protests were about. But I do think that you're starting to see tech companies pay a lot more attention to that broad scale pushback. And so I would say we need more of it, and we need it to keep happening over and over again. I mean, the fact that Google screwed this up, it was disappointing. The fact that Google pulled it immediately and sort of realized the problem is at least encouraging that they're starting to listen and realize that they have to listen.
So you got into an interesting tech conversation on Twitter with Matt Rostoff, the tech writer for CNBC this week. And his argument is, this is just capitalism. It's been there forever. People know. Everyone knows what tech companies are doing, and they don't care because they want to use the product. What do you say to that?
I mean, in my experience, that's just not true. It's not true that everybody knows what tech companies are doing. It is true that they want to use the products. I think that that's true. What he really talked a lot about was how, you know, most people still have a really favorable view of tech companies. And that's fine. I'm not even necessarily arguing with that. What I would push back on is the idea that that means things are fine. I don't think things are fine. I think that what we're starting to see is what are the ramifications of the way that we've let tech work over the past several years. And we're seeing that in things like the Russia investigation at Facebook. We're seeing that in the mass abuse and harassment happening on Twitter and the fact that, you know, there's a huge amount of neo-Nazis on the platform. I mean, this is sort of like the problems really becoming manifest. And so what I would say is that maybe the public doesn't quite realize yet, or isn't as critical yet, but I think that that is coming. And I think that, moreover, it is important for people in the media and for people who are paying attention to the industry and who understand the industry to talk about these problems and share them with the public, because I think the public deserves to know. I think that you shouldn't have to be in technology to have critical opinions of it. Anybody who uses technology should feel a little bit more comfortable talking about it and saying, you know, this doesn't seem right to me. And right now I talk to people left and right who tell me, you know, I feel creeped out by tech. I feel creeped out by Google or Facebook, but I don't really know what to do or how to deal with that. I don't really have any more specifics. You know, it's just a general sense of creepiness. And I think that we can help people get a little bit more comfortable understanding the issues at play, and that when they're more comfortable understanding these issues, that they will have a more nuanced look at tech. We still love a lot of the things that technology has brought us, but that doesn't mean that we have to just take everything else that comes with it. We can have a say in how this industry operates.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Sarah Wachter-Becher is the author of Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. You can buy it wherever you order books. It's available now. It's just came out, so fresh insight into this issue. And I love that you really, you're not anti-tech. You want people to understand it, educate people about it.
I love tech.
And if you want to talk to Sarah on Twitter, she is Sarah_Ann_Marie. On Twitter. Thanks so much, Sarah. So we got some feedback. Okay. Annette and many others of you pointed out that I made a mistake last week. I said that there was no button on the Amazon Echo or the Echo Dot that would let you talk to it without using the wake word. And that's wrong. There is a button.
There is a button. Hallelujah. But it actually works in this case, right?
Yeah, it works. Because last week Google, their button would stick and then it was recording everything. This is an actual physical button as opposed to Google was just like a touch button. But what Annette said is my Echo Dot has two buttons. Two of them are volume controls. The leftmost button is the mute button, meaning Amazon is presumably not listening. And there's the rightmost button. This one activates with a push. Sorry about saying her name, meaning you can click it and say your command. It also acts as a reset button. My hypothesis, since it isn't a touchpad, the button is a physical hardware button. It doesn't create phantom touches, at least not that we know of.
Yeah, that's a hypothesis that I've also heard from others on the topic, that it's because it's a touchpad and because there's fabric that goes over that and there's adhesive that holds it into place, that there's a possibility that, you know, through quality control or whatever, a certain amount of adhesive or a certain kind of position of that fabric touching the touchpad might be what was resulting in some of the devices doing these phantom touches. Mm-hmm. So in that case, I guess deactivation is just the only way to go on the mm-hmm. Google Home Mini, and that's why mm-hmm. Google did it.
Yes, but if you want to email us, if we make a mistake, if we say something amazing, any reason, email us at tnw@twit.tv. We do read your email. We don't get to respond to everything, but we try.
If you'd like your robots mega-sized and battling, then you might be interested to know about Megabots if you didn't know about it already, a full-size realization of the fantasy world many of us have dreamt about with Mech Warrior and all other kinds of sci-fi content of that ilk. Matt Orline is the co-founder of Megabots, and he joins us to talk about the first ever Megabots battle. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Jason.
It's great to have you here. You, by the way, you were on the new Screensavers, I think it was last year, far ahead of the battle that just this week took place. It was on Tuesday. I'm sure a lot evolved from that time to the time of the event a few days ago. What were your biggest concerns going into this mega robot event?
So a lot of concerns about safety, a lot of concerns about logistics. The fight happened in Japan. And so just like getting these large robots across an ocean and into an abandoned warehouse proved to be very difficult for us. And you know, it's dealing with language barrier and, you know, two different cultural perspectives having opinions on, you know, what the first ever world's first giant fighting robot duel should look like. And so, you know, there's a number of complications to work through, but I'm really pleased with the result. A ton of people watched this and tuned in, so we're ecstatic about the success of the event. We get pictures all the time about people that tuned in and had a watch party. You know, people sitting around the living room, you know, having some drinks, watching giant robots battle. I can't think of a better pastime.
Well, and not only that, I mean, the event that you put together, I really got a UFC vibe out of it, right? It was broadcast much like an Ultimate Fighting Championship event. You even went as far as to have veteran UFC commentator Mike Goldberg emceeing the show. Battle is one thing, and that's kind of what we're seeing here. I think this is the like pinnacle battle at the end of the event. But TV is something entirely different. How challenging was the process of making this event that we really haven't seen anything of this scale done before, making it an engaging viewing experience on the screen?
Yeah, so you know, these are prototype robots. They're like the first piloted combat robots, you know, humanoid robots that have really ever been created that can perform like this. And so, you know, the first fight, we chose to pre-record it because there's just so many unknowns. We really didn't know what was going to happen from a safety perspective, and so you know, the fight was actually filmed over a number of days. You know, each round was kind of a different day, and we had to repair the robots kind of between and kind of get set up and reset the battleground and stuff like that. So the goal here really is to give people kind of an MVP, so to speak, minimum viable product on like what giant fighting robots could look like. Kind of give them that vision of like, you know, there's commentators there, just like epic damage happening, roaring engines. It's to kind of guide people's imagination on like what this could be. You know, imagine that in front of 60,000 people in a stadium.
So I noticed behind you, there looks to be a poster for maybe the California safety rules. And I'm wondering, does that apply to the robots? Like, do they also get rights? Is that what that is?
You know, the robots get no rights. You know, we just kind of we just tell them what needs to be done, and they do it. So they're kind of the robots, I would say, are probably our worst treated employees here at Megabots.
Okay. So follow up question: 20 years from now, when the robots are ruling the world, how do you think they'll look back at this interview and think of you?
Yeah, not kindly. I'm just banking on being one of the few people who start the robot apocalypse, and so I'm going to know where the kill switch is.
Okay.
So, you know, by kind of being the first, you take on a little bit of risk, but you can also kind of guide how that happens. So, I don't know. We'll see.
I do have to point out that one of the folks who helps us work on this show every week, Burke, is a big fan of anything chainsaw arm. And so I think he's saying chainsaw arm for the win. Finally, there's a story in the show that actually has a chainsaw arm because one of the final robots disassembled the other robot in the battle with a chainsaw arm. Pretty impressive. What about safety here? I mean, bodily injury concerns. The people that created these things are inside operating them. How did that go?
Yeah, you know, the cockpits of the robots are actually pretty well armored. And so we specifically looked at all of the weapons we were bringing to the fight, and each team, you know, beforehand kind of decided on like, okay, there aren't going to be any flamethrowers. There aren't going to be any like, huge spike lances that like just drive straight through armor. We wanted to keep, you know, we designed the robots and the weapon systems to sort of give people a compelling and engaging fight without putting the pilots in danger too much. So we're not trying to kill people here. We're trying to give people an entertaining sport, and I think we did a really good job doing that.
Yeah.
What about autonomous robots? Is that something you're working on?
That is, you know, that's pretty far off. I think, you know, we like the idea of having people inside the robots. You know, it just adds that kind of element of excitement and danger and, you know, what is the pilot experiencing? And you're kind of thinking about what it's like to be a robot pilot. So we really like that aspect of it. Autonomous robots that can fight and look awesome are pretty far off right now. And I think even if you ask a roboticist, they would probably even say that what we're piloting are not even robots. They're armored vehicles. And so, you know, we thought long and hard about like, what are we actually going to call these things? But we decided that culturally, you know, like maybe, you know, a purist roboticist would say that's not a robot, but culturally we do think they're robots. Like if you put a person in front of it and you go, what is that big thing in front of you? They'll probably go, oh, well, that's a robot. No one would go, oh, that's an armored vehicle. So that's why we chose to call it giant fighting robots.
So I know that, that in Japan, there's a different idea, different culture around robots. It's more acceptable than in some ways than it is in the United States. But people were really into this. What do you think our fascination here in the United States is with giant fighting robots? Why are we so fascinated by them?
Yeah, you know, I think for this particular event, it's really the story, you know, this nation-on-nation competition that really drove this, you know, to kind of the mass market appeal that it had. But, you know, definitely I grew up, you know, playing video games. Mech Warrior was a big one that I played. But, you know, we still had, you know, Power Rangers as kids, the Megazord. We have Transformers, very popular in America. So, you know, I think there's it's not as embedded in the culture as it is perhaps in Japan. But I think there's still a significant amount of exposure to it in a lot of people's childhoods here in America.
So big time props for making this happen. It's been a long time coming, and I know people have been waiting definitely, I mean, literally a few years now to kind of see the end result. What is next? I have to imagine this isn't the one and only battle. Is there another one that you're already working on down the line, or what do you think is going to happen?
This is not the end. You know, our next steps are to, you know, we had the prototype battle, and the next steps are to blow this up into an entire sports league. So we want, you know, many, many teams creating their robots. You know, you can follow their social media, see what they're doing. They all come together in one big tournament. That's really what we're working towards next. But hope, you know, many, many, we'll have some battles along the way. Hopefully, I know there's a couple robots in China that are looking to fight us. And other countries around the world that have expressed some interest. So hopefully we can maybe have some of those fights along the way.
Yeah, and we are at the beginning stages of this new genre, which you are bringing to the surface. So thank you for that. Matt Orlein is the co-founder of Megabots. Go to megabots.com if you want to find out more, and you can find the full, I think it's the full broadcast. I was watching it on YouTube, so it's pretty easily accessible. But thank you for doing this. Where do you want people to follow you online if they want to keep tabs on you?
Oof. Facebook, Instagram, Megabots Inc. is our handle there. On Twitter, our handle is Megabots. They can go to the website, and all the links are there on the website, megabots.com. There's a mailing list. Tons of places you can follow us. We have a Twitch channel, Megabots Inc. Pick your social media of choice.
Right on. Excellent. Thank you so much, Matt, and congratulations.
Thanks, Jason.
All right, take care.
This week, Qualcomm claimed to have the first working 5G data connection on a mobile device. Joining us to explain what this means and when we'll get to use it is Sharif Hanna from Qualcomm. Welcome to the show, Sharif.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I am someone who constantly says gigabyte when I mean gigabit. I just want everything to be faster. What does this announcement really mean?
So we're in the middle of putting together the definition for the next generation of cellular technology. So currently, you know, if you have, I would say mostly if you buy a smartphone today, you have 4G LTE capability in it. So you can access the internet, you know, while on the go pretty quickly. And the industry is currently working together to define the next generation of cellular, which is 5G, which promises a whole bunch of new improvements. Obviously, faster internet speeds is one of them, but also a whole class of new services. So we can connect more IoT devices and even make, you know, autonomous cars talk to each other in real time. So a lot of very exciting things coming down very soon.
So 5G, it's not five of anything, right? It's just, it's like the iPhone 5. It comes after 4. I mean, does it, are you sort of making it up as you go along, or is it an industry standard 5G?
No, this is industry standard 5G. So okay. There is a standards body called the 3GPP. You know, it's funny because it started when we were defining the third generation and they just stuck with the name, I guess. So it's still called the 3GPP. That is defining, you know, one generation of cellular technology after the other. And so 5G just literally means the fifth generation of cellular technology. So yeah, there is in fact a worldwide global standard for 5G that is being defined as we speak. And we're going to be done with the definition. Actually, the first version of the 5G spec will be done this December. So we're really only 2 months away from, you know, the first specification standard for 5G.
What I've heard a lot of people, and we, you know, we've talked about it on Tech News Today a decent amount of times, talk about kind of like this emerging 5G and how it's going to make everything faster and better and all that kind of stuff. But around that, things get really mucky because there have been a lot of different approaches. You know, everybody has their own, it seems like anyways, up until now, everybody has their own take on what 5G actually means. What would you say is right. The most common misconception about that you've heard about 5G technology?
I think the most common misconception is that nobody knows what 5G looks like and that no standard yet exists. Mm-hmm. The reality is that actually the industry has been working together for about 2 years now, putting together a definition of 5G. So we actually have a pretty good idea of what it looks like. And not just Qualcomm. I'm saying the industry as a whole. So this is, you know, companies that make chipsets that go into smartphones like us, as well as, you know, the mobile network operators like AT&T, Verizon, et cetera, and you know, the international counterparts, and even the smartphone makers like Samsung, LG, et cetera. So we've all been working together for the past little while. And like I said, actually, things are looking pretty good. I think, you know, right from the get-go, there were three kind of major objectives for this new generation. So one is obviously making, you know, internet connections on the go faster. And by faster, we mean way, way faster, right? So several gigabits a second will be possible, you know, to a smartphone or a laptop or to a car that has 5G connectivity. So that's one. And that one is pretty obvious, right? Everything just gets faster. The second one is the ability to support, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of IoT devices, right? And in doing it in such a way that it's really very low cost to put 5G cellular connectivity inside any object that you can imagine, and also low power enough so that if it runs on a battery, that, you know, the battery can last for a long time. So that's the second objective. And then the third objective is what we call ultra-reliable, ultra-low latency. And so that means that you can actually put a cellular connection on a mission-critical device and expect it to behave just as, you know, reliably as if it were connected by a wire. So you can imagine a situation, for example, where you have autonomous cars, that have to communicate to each with each other to coordinate. You know, maybe the two cars are coming to an intersection at the same time, and they need to coordinate between each other. You need to be able to, you know, for one car to send a message to the other car, and you know with absolute certainty that the message is going to make it to the other side, so they can arbitrate who's going to brake and who's going to go through the intersection first, for example, right? And so we are already defining that into the standard right from the get-go, as opposed to bolting on some of these features as an afterthought, which I think in the case of 4G, originally we conceived it just for mobile broadband, so fast internet access on the go. And then we started bolting on, you know, other technologies later. But from 5G, we're designing that stuff right from the get-go. So we have a pretty good idea of, you know, what the technology is, and how it works and what applications it's going to be good for.
I should mention that Qualcomm is one of our sponsors, but that's not why we had Sharif on.
Yeah.
You are you watched Twit and you saw Leo,
yes,
and some others talking about it, and you said, you know what, I'm going to explain to you a little bit about what 5G means. And so I thank you for that. And when we're going to get it. So when will we get it? Do you have any? I know this is, you're still doing testing,
right?
So when can I get it?
Well, this is why also part of the significance of the announcement this week. And so we are currently on track to have the first 5G-enabled smartphones and networks in the first half of 2019. And so what we have been able to do so far is actually get the modem, which is the chip inside your smartphone that connects your phone to the cellular network. So we've actually been able to get a working 5G modem. So we fired it up in the lab a few weeks ago. We got it up and running, and we first made the first 5G connection on a chip made for mobile devices. And we also announced our first smartphone reference design for 5G. So that means that this is a device that really looks like a real smartphone. You can hold it in your hand. And what we're going to do with it is we're going to take it out into the field and start testing and, you know, optimizing our products and then giving it to the, you know, the companies that make smartphones so that it can actually make a 5G capable smartphone and have it in users' hands in early 2019. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, obviously, over the next 12 months or so. But so far, it's going well. We're making steady progress. And, you know, this milestone this week was, you know, another step on this path.
All right. So now the really tough question. So 6G, what do you think?
You know, it's interesting. We actually have one of our VPs, senior VPs, who's responsible for modem product management. He's the guy that actually overlooks the portfolio of, you know, cellular modem products. He said this may be the last G ever. And what we mean by that is, we're actually baking in, again, the ability to add additional features in the future and revise the standard over the long period. And actually, we saw the same thing with LTE. So with the LTE standard, we've had about 6 revisions so far. So the technology has actually evolved from the very first networks that were deployed quite a bit, to the point where you can get, you know, gigabit per second over LTE today. And so, you know, there's been an evolution of that standard. And with 5G, we believe that we will be evolving it for a very long time to keep adding new features and capabilities. So, you know, some people are saying, like I said, that this could be the last G ever, but never say never, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to quote you on that. I'm ready for the last G because it's too confusing.
It's, you know, faster, better, smarter, you know, connectivity. It's interesting because we think of connectivity as kind of the new electricity, right? And what we mean by that is, if you really can add, you know, connectivity that works anywhere, right, to any object that you can imagine, that really changes things, right? You can really start to capture a lot of data and control things remotely. And, you know, with the advent of AI and everything else on top of it, you know, there's a lot of benefits to society that we think that can come out of it. So it's exciting times, early days, of course, but we're making good progress.
So Bleak in our chat room asked what phone you were using the 5G on, but it sounds like it's not really a phone. It's just a prototype of something that you're using.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah. So the early demonstration was on a prototype smartphone, essentially. It's not commercial by any means. Yeah. So that's actually a render of it. The president of our company held it up actually at our event earlier this week, and people were going nuts actually. So it was, you know, you bring together all the people in cellular industry in one room and they see that, and, you know, the phones were ringing off the hook, basically everybody saying that they want to see it. They want to start playing with it. So it's exciting times and good progress.
So what phone do you use on a regular basis? What's in your pocket right now?
Galaxy S8.
Yeah, good
thing. Thank you so much for joining us, Sharif. Sharif Hanna is a product and technology marketing lead for Qualcomm Mobile. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Sharif.
Of course, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Have a good night.
And finally, yes. Tonight, as Halloween approaches, Snap, makers of Snapchat, is apparently pivoting to a new business model.
Mm-hmm.
Costumes. The Verge reports that Snap is selling an $80 hot dog costume. It is available on Amazon, and it is awesome.
$80.
That's a decent price for a Halloween costume.
I guarantee you they don't have tall sizes. Not that I'd get one, but actually I might if it was in tall size, because I have no options.
I think it looks uncomfortable. I don't like a mask that covers my total face.
But how else are you going to be a dancing hot dog?
That's true. Yeah. I bet you can make it. Make it.
Yeah. Speaking of making it, by the way, if you're totally ambitious, you don't have to like buy this pre-made Snapchat costume. Mm-hmm. You can totally do the puking rainbow costume. Mm-hmm. All by yourself if you're good at makeup and face paint and stuff, I suppose. But you know, what a weird world we live in.
Yeah. Also, costume. What you could do is just take a picture of yourself with a Snapchat filter and then stay at home.
That's
and
true.
Not leave your house.
Snapchat actually makes it really easy for Halloween.
Yes.
You just point the camera at you and shoot.
I totally want you to do that. Although I know what your Halloween costume is, and it's not that. And I'm not going to say what it is.
Oh, yeah. Don't spoil the surprise.
No, I won't.
Don't spoil it. Mm-mm. All right. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show. We love getting your emails, and we'll include them in the show if you email us at tnw@twit.tv.
Subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. Subscribe for yourself. No one has told me yet that it's illegal to subscribe to your friend for your friends. So do it. Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, get ours. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director and editor, Josh. Josh, you jumped through fiery hoops today, and we appreciate it. Thank you. Also, thanks to our studio engineer, Burke. And thanks to Colleen for walking around the studio and staring at us all day. It's okay. We appreciate your help, too. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We really appreciate it. We will see you next week on Tech News Weekly. Bye.